If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Good morning. President Trump went to Pennsylvania to tell voters he's bringing down prices. Most voters blame him for the economy's troubles, and Trump didn't announce any new policies to turn things around. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, the West Contra Costa teacher strike is over. A deal reached this morning. I'm Brian Watt.
A community of highly trained Afghan soldiers who fought against the Taliban for the CIA now feel abandoned by the CIA. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. Four have died by suicide. Another is a suspect in the D.C. National Guard shooting. Also, Hamas tells NPR it is willing to give up its weapons for up to 10 years, but only if there are negotiations with Israel about a Palestinian state. It's Wednesday, December 10th. On this day in 1869, the governor of the Wyoming Territory signed the first U.S. law explicitly granting women the right to vote. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump traveled to central Pennsylvania last night for a rally focused on the U.S. economy. He often left that topic to insult his political enemies or use foul language to denigrate black immigrants. NPR's Domenico Montanaro reports this was a White House effort to change the public's view of how Trump is handling the economy.
Trump has repeatedly downplayed the importance of cost of living as a factor in people's lives. He's called affordability a con job cooked up by Democrats, but people know what they're paying, and most people think that Trump is making things worse. Polling averages have found majorities disapproving of Trump's handling of the economy, a big turnaround from his first term. And presidents often get more credit and blame than they deserve on the economy, but people are saying that Trump's policies, particularly his tariffs, have made prices and the cost of doing business higher. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News. Washington.
Some farmers say they're encouraged by Trump's $12 billion aid package. It's meant to help the farmers cope with losses during his trade war with China. But it's not clear the one-time windfall will be enough to prevent many farm bankruptcies and foreclosures. NPR's Kirk Siegler reports from South Dakota.
These bridge payments, as the president is calling them, should be coming to farmers early next year. Many, like Kevin Deinert, are on thin margins due to inflation, tariffs, and Trump's trade war closing off Asian markets for soybeans. Most here in the Dakotas are grown for export.
And, you know, as farmers, we want trade, not aid. This bridge payment's just going to kind of maybe help pay for inputs as we go into the next year.
Pretty much all of Deinert's soybeans are still sitting in storage. He's holding out for higher prices and is counting on the administration's promises that it's secured deals with China so that country begins importing commodities from the U.S. again. Kirk Siegler, NPR News, Mitchell, South Dakota.
Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado did not make it to Oslo today in time to receive her Nobel Peace Prize personally, but the Norwegian Nobel Institute says she is safe and headed to Oslo. Officials disclosed the moment they managed to reach Machado, as Julia Carnero reports.
Hello?
Hello?
Jorgen?
Hi.
Hi, Jorgen?
Is it Maria Corina?
Yes.
Maria Corina Machado was about to get on a plane when the chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Jorgen Vatne Fridnes, managed to reach her, finally confirming that she was safe and would make it to Oslo. On the phone call, Machado told him many people had to risk their lives for her to leave Venezuela. There was a standing ovation at the ceremony as Fridnes handed the prize to her daughter. He said they were honoring Machado and paying tribute to all who wait in the dark in Venezuela and suffer the violence of Nicolas Maduro's, quote, brutal regime. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro.
On Wall Street and pre-market trading, Dow futures are flat. You're listening to NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. A deal has been reached to end the strike by West Contra Costa school teachers. The district and the teachers' union say they reached a tentative agreement this morning that includes salary and health care increases, among other things. Their bargaining session ended at 2 a.m. District officials say schools will remain open today and that classes will return to normal tomorrow. The deal now goes to members of the United Teachers of Richmond and the district board for ratification. The strike, which began last Thursday, was the first ever by the teachers' union. Oakland officials announced Tuesday that the city has sold over $330 million in general obligation bonds. KQED's Alex Hall reports on what this means for the chronically cash-strapped city.
The bond sale is expected to provide Oakland with capital funding for things like paving roads, renovating parks, libraries, and senior centers, and investing in affordable housing. Mayor Barbara Lee called it a sign that financial markets have confidence in the direction Oakland is heading.
When the financial market believes in Oakland's direction and in Oakland, that helps us fund the work that the residents deserve and need.
Voters authorized the city to issue bonds for infrastructure projects back in 2022, but officials delayed because of concerns over the city's downgraded credit rating. Officials say funds from the bonds should become available within the next 2 weeks. I'm Alex Hall, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. Good morning.
Support comes from Oakland, San Francisco Bay Airport, beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at Lemelson.org. And the listeners and sustaining members of KQED. Mel Baker checks in at 6:06 this morning as we take a glance at the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge.
More traffic is beginning to slow around Castro Street as you head up to the toll plaza. Meanwhile, on the Bay Bridge, the backup is nearly to the maze. Not quite there yet, but is slowing at least back to the maze, and it is slow all the way across the upper deck well into San Francisco. Meanwhile, there's a dense fog advisory for all of Sonoma County, especially affecting parts of the 101 corridor, and dense fog along Highway 4 in the Martinez area. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. On KQED News, more about school districts. The Oakland Unified School District is facing budget troubles again. The district's board is now expected to vote on major cuts, with a plan calling for potential school closures and mergers. Money and Oakland schools, the details on the way for you at 6:22 on KQED News. Sacramento Valley, another day of clouds, areas of dense fog this morning, and a little later today, the Weather Service says hazy throughout most of today. There's even some early afternoon fog still in the forecast. And cooler high temperatures today. Highs will only be from 44 to about 51. Today's predicted high in Sacramento, 47 degrees. Bay Area, look for areas of dense fog. As Mel mentioned, drive carefully this morning. Highs only in the mid-50s to the 60s. Also, the Weather Service has issued a beach hazard statement.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. President Trump told a rally crowd in Pennsylvania Tuesday night that he has no higher priority than making America affordable again.
They caused the high prices and we're bringing them down. It's a simple message. If I had one message tonight, you know, this is being covered like all over the world. This is crazy because I haven't made a speech in a little while. You know, when you win, you say, oh, I can now rest.
He talked about a whole lot of other things, too.
And NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith is here to help us decipher what the president had to say. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning.
So did the president have some new message or some policy prescriptions for Americans who are upset about the high cost of living?
The banners on the stage said, lower prices, bigger paychecks. And that was the message, in essence. Trump insists prices are coming down and brought up on the stage a handful of people who stand to benefit from the tax cuts he signed into law earlier this year. There were no new policies and not a lot of new material. But if you go to see the Village People, you'd be disappointed not to hear YMCA. So Trump spent much of this 90-minute speech going through the greatest hits, talking about how members of his cabinet are straight out of central casting, denigrating Somali immigrants, weaving all over the place, joking about how it would be boring if he stuck to the teleprompter, and occasionally making it back to the economy.
Lower prices, bigger paychecks. We're getting inflation. We're crushing it. And you're getting much higher wages. I mean, the only thing that that's really going up big, it's called the stock market and your 401ks. It's going up.
Okay, that might be true. Stock values are up, but a lot of people, actually more than a third of Americans, don't have money in the stock market.
Yeah, and as our friends at Marketplace always say, the stock market is not the economy. A recent Fox News poll found 3/4 of voters view the economy negatively, and 2-1, they blame Trump for the current economy rather than former President Biden. The economy used to be Trump's strength, but at the moment, it's a major weakness, and Democrats are certainly making the most of it. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro posted on social media that Trump spent his speech, quote, telling Pennsylvanians not to believe what they can see with their own two eyes, the skyrocketing cost of living and rising prices at the grocery store.
So how is the president squaring the sour mood that voters are in with his pitch that he has ushered in a golden age for this country?
He's not really. Take this from an interview he did this week with Politico's Dasha Burns.
I wonder what grade you would give.
A plus.
Economy. A plus.
Yeah, A plus, 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 plus.
You know, Trump typically has strong instincts for appealing to his base, but he does risk looking out of touch here.
And how does he respond when confronted with those concerns?
Last night, yet again, he mocked the preoccupation with affordability.
They have a new word. You know, they always have a hoax. The new word is affordability.
He says that he inherited a mess. In other words, don't blame me, blame the former guy. And he says things are already cheaper. In particular, he talks a lot about gas prices. According to Gas Buddy, prices are down about 8 cents on average a gallon from a year ago. But that's not really enough savings to make up for higher grocery prices and utility bills and health care costs.
That is NPR's Tamara Keith. Tam, thank you.
You're welcome.
For more on President Trump's efforts to both downplay affordability concerns and blame the Biden administration for the cost of living, we're joined by political consultant and pollster Frank Luntz to break down what's behind the rhetoric. Good morning, Frank, and thanks for being back on the program.
Thanks for having me. And I do want to focus on what Tamara just said. Lower prices, bigger paychecks. The issue for him, the challenge, is that he does look out of touch if he's saying that affordability is, in his words, a hoax.
Yeah.
The American people do believe that they're paying more, and the core elements, and you can call this F squared, H squared, food and fuel, housing and healthcare. The public believes that, and now it's almost half the public struggles paycheck to paycheck. And when they see the president saying that prices are coming down, it may be true. I'm not going to argue over the details, but I will argue over the perceptions. And when you talk about affordability, it is all perception. The greatest danger is if you tell people that happy days are here again and it's 1929.
You know, you mentioned that he keeps saying affordability is just a Democratic hoax. Why is this such a difficult issue for Trump to own?
Because he owned it against Joe Biden just a year ago. This is the reason why he was able to defeat President Biden, is because the public thought that the former president didn't do enough to bring prices down. And the Trump campaign hammered him day after day, effectively saying you're paying too much and you're getting too little.
How will this impact Republicans heading into next year's midterms?
Well, here's the thing. There's actually time to fix this. Mm. That people are not making decisions over who they're going to vote for in November of 2026, in December of 2025. And the key date for me is Labor Day. Around Labor Day, the public makes a decision, has this administration, has the people in charge been effective and efficient and accountable? Do they have a track record of meaningful, measurable success? That decision will not happen for another 9 months. But what's critical for the president, if I were advising him, which I don't, but if I were advising him, I would lean into this because this is what the public believes. And you can't tell them something that they don't feel at the pump, that they don't feel at the cash register. And particularly the next issue, insurance, health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Our prices going up. If I were a Republican strategist, which I used to be, I'd be telling them that that is the issue that could cost you the majority.
Well, it seems like so far Trump has taken no accountability for any issues around for affordability, either blaming the Biden administration or saying it's completely made up.
Well, again, I don't want to focus on policy. I focus on the language because that's my profession. But it is a legitimate attack to say that inflation was much higher, which much more significant under Joe Biden, and that the country continued to spend because of COVID months or even years after it should have. That said, it's now a year since the election, and the public does expect this administration to take charge. At a certain point, they will not accept the blame game. He may be responsible, but you, President Trump, you promised to fix it. Are you doing it?
And how is that showing up in the polls? I mean, how is this messaging resonating with Americans?
Well, I don't think it's necessary. And this is the good news for the Republicans, is that the Democrats aren't liked either. And this is the bad news for America, that both political parties are failing. Both political parties aren't offering the results and the success that they have promised. And so the public is starting to look at this and say, to heck with all of you. You've made promises you cannot keep. I don't trust you anymore. But because the Republicans are in charge, they're the ones that pay the price. They're the ones that have to deliver. So in the end, the blame game may work today. In December of 2025, it will not work November of 2026.
Do you see affordability right now as a winning message for the Democrats? I mean, we saw that play big in the New York City mayor election.
Absolutely, because it's a day-to-day issue. It's not really ideological. People are genuinely suffering. And when you're living, and I don't use the word blue collar, I don't talk about middle class. I talk about paycheck to paycheck, because that's how people live. And that paycheck-to-paycheck voter is annoyed. Democrats are coming out to the polls. Republicans are staying home. And if that continues, that spells bad news for the Republicans. But I end this interview as I began. It is not too late. The election is still 10 months away. Things can be very different November than they are right now.
Frank Luntz is a political consultant and pollster. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
It's an honor. Thank you.
The number of high school seniors or their parents filling out the federal form for access to college financial aid, the FAFSA, is way up this fall. That's despite indications that many Americans are souring on the importance of higher education. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports.
Seeing so many students fill out the financial aid form matters because it's often a critical step in the college process, and it's correlated with more students enrolling in college next year. Sean Sobush is a high school senior in Florida. He'd heard from a friend's older sister that filling out the form called the FAFSA took her several hours.
I did go into it expecting it to take the whole afternoon.
But this fall, when he opened up his laptop at his local Starbucks and navigated to the online form, it only took about 15 minutes to complete.
So it was really simple, and I mean, it definitely was a welcoming surprise.
Sobush is among the more than a million high school seniors who have already filled out the FAFSA, up about 6% compared to 2023.
It's good to have good news about the FAFSA.
Bill DeBon is with the National College Attainment Network, an organization that helps track FAFSA completion.
Nationally, we're aiming for all-time highs in FAFSA completion this year.
There are two main reasons the numbers are so high this year. The form is much simpler, thanks to recent federal legislation. And in addition to being fast and easy, the form was also made available way earlier this year, on September 24th. In the 2 years prior, the form didn't open up until sometime in December.
We have had a strong start. We should continue that momentum, right?
DeBon says schools shouldn't get too cocky. To reach an all-time high FAFSA completion, at least a million more students still need to fill out the form by summer, at a time when confidence in higher ed generally is really low. This distinction rings true for Sobush in Florida.
I feel like a lot of students are worried that it will not be worth it in the future.
But yet, it sounds like everybody is still applying?
Yeah.
Is that right?
It is kind of contradictory. But I think if they can attend for a lower cost, that it is worth the risk.
And in order to do that, they first have to fill out the FAFSA. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
On member-supported KQED. Good morning, I'm Dave Freeman. 6:19 is the time on this Wednesday. Ahead in just a few minutes, Brian Watt with the latest KQED news. Traffic news, Mel Baker has the latest, a morning rundown for us.
Yeah, we're going to Napa County and Oakville, Highway 29 before Gloss Lane. And emergency units are on the scene of a two-vehicle crash that's blocking the shoulder but maybe partially blocking lane. Traffic is slowing in both directions. Vallejo 37 westbound from the Mare Island Bridge to the lane merge. That's solid right now and just kind of creeping along. Out in Pittsburgh, Highway 4 westbound before Bailey Road. Two-car crash. That's been pushed over to the center divide, but traffic is slow back to Harbor Street. Around Martinez, you can expect some fog along Highway 4. Mel Baker for KQED.
Morning traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Left-Handed Girl, Taiwan's official submission for international feature at the Academy Awards. A fresh beginning in Taipei comes with Generations of Secrets, now on Netflix, awards eligible. Genentech, the original biotech pioneer forging life-altering scientific breakthroughs to help improve the lives of all patients. Learn more about Genentech's commitment to patients and society at gene.com/ourpromise. On the way in 1/2 hour.
Next on the California Report, California used to build condos as an affordable path to home ownership. Now, they're nearly vanished, and a growing group of housing advocates say state laws are partly to blame. I'm Avi Bolaños. We dig into what happened and what it would take to bring condos back on the next California Report.
On Forum at 9, Forum talks with leading researchers at the University of California about federal cuts to health research funds. That topic and more on Forum 9 to 11 today. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters this Friday. The NPR Wine Club now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at Progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And the listeners and members of KQED. The time coming up on 6:22.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. This is a busy, challenging moment for Bay Area public school districts. Early this morning, the West Contra Costa Unified School District reached a tentative contract agreement with its teachers, who have been on strike since last week. Later today, the board for the Oakland Unified School District is set to vote on big budget cuts. How big? $100 million. Or else OUSD risks another county or state takeover. Here to explain all this is Ashley McBride, education equity reporter for the Oakland side. Ashley, hello.
Hi, Brian.
So first off, tell us more about the district's latest plans to slash the budget.
Yeah, so for years, OUSD has had a structural deficit. And over the last few years, they've been able to use one-time dollars to kind of paper over that deficit. But the last of those COVID relief dollars expired last year. So there's really no other option at this point than to make cuts and restructure the district. The plan that the board majority has been pushing for is for the central office, which is the district headquarters, to be consolidated.
Okay, so what kind of expenses are we talking about when you describe the central office of the district?
I think Sandra Aguilera, OUSD's chief academic officer, summed it up pretty well at a meeting a few weeks ago when she said there are very few positions at the central office that directly serve students, but that the role of the central office is to develop the adults who work with students. So things like providing training and professional development for staff. The central office also provides a lot of support to principals in running their schools, the facilities and buildings and grounds divisions, things like that.
Okay. What impact could this all have on classrooms?
So last month when staff presented the central office restructuring plan to the board, it only reached about $21 million. So there will almost certainly be cuts at school sites. People will probably be laid off because staffing costs are the biggest slice of OUSD spending. And so if the board approves the plan, then the real work will begin at each school, figuring out exactly what to cut. So that could mean like sports programs or extracurriculars that are paid for with discretionary funding.
But that still seems like a long way to get to the 100 million. They got a lot to figure out here, right?
Yes. The plan that Superintendent Sadler is presenting amounts to about $102 million. So there were some categories that I haven't mentioned that include a reduction in special education spending, for example. So it'll impact all parts of the district. And this December 10th meeting is crucial because the district has to submit their budget plan to Alameda County by Monday, December 15th. And if the county superintendent feels that the plan is lacking or she has criticisms of it, it could move the district closer to going back into receivership.
And this budget debate is likely serving as a test of sorts for the interim superintendent, Denise Sadler, right? I mean, she took on the role just as the district was leaving state takeover for the first time in years. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, the board separated from former Superintendent Kyla Johnson Trammell earlier this year, and Sadler took over in July. And what's interesting to me right now is that one of the apparent reasons for the separation from Superintendent Johnson Trammell was over school closures. So school closures and mergers seem to be back on the table, and Superintendent Sadler is essentially recommending them.
Wow, a lot to watch here. Ashley, thank you.
Thank you.
Ashley McBride covers education for the Oakland side. Among the challenges facing people leaving incarceration is housing. One Bay Area nonprofit is trying to meet this need, and it's now expanding into San Francisco. Here's KQED's Azul Dostromekman.
Here's how it works. People leaving incarceration are matched with people like Mimi Vaughn, who have a room to spare.
I was super skeptical. I'm like, I don't know if I want to live with anyone, let alone live with a person who's been formerly incarcerated.
Participants get a stable place to live, rent-free, for 6 months while they get help finding a job and a place of their own. In exchange, the hosts get around $1,500 a month. That tipped the scales for Vaughn. At the time, she was a single mother of two and wanted to put her kids through college.
I was like, okay, if I do this, then my kids will come out with zero student loan debt.
Over the past 3 years, she's gone on to host 19 participants between her two homes in Oakland. She says it's been rewarding.
It's funny because they always say that they learn a lot from me, and I say that I've learned a lot from them.
All right, do that one more time. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Oh, so much better. You could tell I was a teacher.
Recently, dozens of people celebrated the expansion of the Homecoming Project into San Francisco at the city's Public Defender's Office. The effort began in Alameda County in 2018 and has reached Contra Costa and Los Angeles counties as well. Currently, there are 17 hosts participating. Bernadette Butler heads the Housing Lab at Impact Justice. That's the nonprofit which runs the program.
This is, at the heart, a way to address homelessness.
She cites a grim statistic. People who are formerly incarcerated are nearly 10 times more likely to experience homelessness than the general population. Danielle Harris is with the Public Defender's Office. She says in the past, the office has worked with the program, but that meant they could only place people with hosts in other counties.
We don't ever, as San Franciscans, want to say we are looking to other counties for services that our folks here in San Francisco need, that our families here in San Francisco need.
Over 200 people have graduated from the Homecoming Project so far, and one of them is Felipe Kelly.
Unfortunately, I pay rent. I pay rent right now, so I'm not a participant anymore, but it was great, though. I had a blast.
He was incarcerated at San Quentin Rehabilitation Center for 6 years. After his release, he was placed in transitional housing in Oakland, but he says he wasn't happy with that living arrangement. Eventually, he moved in with Mimi Vaughn through the Homecoming Project.
To be able to live in a place where you can walk outside your door, and you can just breathe the fresh air, you can just look around, you can feel safe, and you can feel comfortable, you can feel happy where you're at, means a lot.
The Homecoming Project is now looking for hosts in San Francisco. The organization says no one living in the city has signed up yet. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
Here's traffic with Mel.
In San Francisco, 280 southbound after Cesar Chavez, reports of a possible fire burning on the shoulder. Northbound on 101 from 280 up to the hospital curve is a bit slow. On the Bay Bridge, the backup is now solidly to the maze. Metering lights, of course, are on. It remains slow all the way to Fremont Street in San Francisco along the upper deck. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for healthcare. And Postman, used by over 40 million developers and 98% of the Fortune 500. Postman offers a platform where teams build APIs that help AI agents and humans make smarter decisions. More at postman.com. More news ahead from NPR and KQED News next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Most economists expect the Federal Reserve to announce another cut in interest rates today. NPR's Scott Horsley says it would be the Fed's third rate reduction since September amid a slowdown in hiring in the U.S.
The Fed has cut interest rates by a quarter percentage point at each of its last two meetings, and investors expect another quarter point cut today as the central bank tries to prop up a sagging job market. Not everyone on the rate-setting committee agrees, however, that another reduction is warranted. Hawkish committee members are more concerned about stubbornly high inflation and may vote to hold interest rates steady. The Fed is working with less information than usual since the six-week government shutdown prevented federal workers from collecting data on inflation and unemployment in October. November's numbers have also been delayed until next week, too late to guide Fed policymakers in their decision today. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Associated Press reports two U.S. Navy fighter jets flew over the Gulf of Venezuela yesterday in what a defense official describes as a routine training flight. It lasted more than 30 minutes. It comes amid a U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean, amid the Pentagon having ordered airstrikes on suspected drug boats off Venezuela. One such strike that killed survivors of an initial attack in September has come under scrutiny. This is NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. As of today, Bay Area families say Sutter Health is dropping gender-affirming care for patients under 19 years old, leaving patients with limited options. KQED's Natalia Navarro reports.
Sutter, like Kaiser Permanente and Stanford Healthcare in the Bay Area, halted gender-affirming surgeries for minors earlier this year, but recently patients' families were told Sutter will also stop offering puberty blockers and hormone therapy for minors. It's unclear if that includes mental health counseling for children with gender dysphoria. The change has left many parents of transgender kids feeling betrayed and scrambling to find providers. Surgeries are rare for trans minors, and puberty blockers are reversible, as are some effects of hormone therapy. Sutter Health has not confirmed a policy change. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Conservationists have found coho salmon in a creek on the Sonoma coast for the first time in 60 years. Press Democrat reporter Amy Windsor says Wildlands Conservancy biologists were shocked to find juveniles of the endangered fish swimming in the eastern branch of the Russian Gulch. Windsor says that's likely due to a few wet winters and conservation efforts in the area.
They removed stumps that were 15 feet high from these stream beds. They cleared the sediment and made a 3.5 mile long channel. You know, there were decades of logging, including industrial scale operations. The gravel beds that salmon need for spawning were completely buried.
Windsor says this is a good sign, but still a fraction of the historical numbers of coho. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from San Francisco Bay University with degrees in tech and business for an AI-driven economy, sfbu.edu. Support for KQED comes from Silicon Valley Community Foundation, raising funds as a response to recent public policy changes to support local nonprofits that provide access to food, health care, and shelter to those in need. More at svcf.org. Every story you hear on KQED exists because of listener support. Turn up the volume on local voices. Give anytime at kqed.org/donate. Thank you for your gift. Coming up on Morning Edition, the man accused of shooting two National Guard troops last month was one of many highly trained Afghan soldiers who fought for the CIA against the Taliban. Details ahead. Support for NPR comes from BritBox, committed to helping viewers unbox the unexpected over the holidays with British TV, including original series Linley and a new season of Karen Peary, streaming at BritBox.com. Your part-time controller specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. A community of Afghan soldiers who fought against the Taliban for the CIA now feel abandoned by the agency.
One member of that community, Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, is accused of shooting two National Guard soldiers last month. NPR spoke to people involved in the Zero units and learned some have struggled with mental health since coming to the U.S. At least four soldiers have died by suicide.
NPR's Brian Mann has our exclusive reporting this morning. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Michelle.
Lakhanwal was part of an Afghan Zero unit. What does that mean?
Michelle, these were Afghan special forces fighting against the Taliban. I spoke with Geeta Bakshi. She's a former CIA agent who spent 4 years in Afghanistan, often working with these Zero unit troops.
These guys were the tip of the spear. They were out on the front so that American personnel didn't have to be. They were the ones that were facing the maximum danger on the battlefield.
And their tactics were often brutal. Groups like Human Rights Watch accused them of engaging in torture and illegal killings. Thousands of these Zero Unit soldiers, including Lakhanwal, were evacuated to the U.S. in 2021 after the Taliban took control of Afghanistan.
You have learned that many of these Zero Unit fighters are struggling. Why is that?
NPR reported last week, Michelle, that before the attack in Washington, D.C., Lakhanwal appeared to be experiencing a personal crisis. He's since pleaded not guilty to murder and other crimes. Now people involved in these units tell me that many of Lakhanwal's fellow Zero Unit fighters have felt similar stress and isolation and despair. They describe feeling betrayed and abandoned by the CIA after years of that frontline combat service. They expected to be treated with respect in the U.S., given a chance to start new lives here. Instead, they found themselves tangled in a complicated immigration process, often stuck without permanent asylum or work visas for years. And I spoke about this with one Zero Unit fighter named Daoud.
It's like that feeling of like you did something, but nobody is appreciating. And the promise that was given to you by your employer was a fake promise.
Now, Daoud agreed to speak with NPR if we agreed to only use his first name. He said he fears for the safety of his family still living in Afghanistan under the Taliban. He told me when Zero Unit fighters living in the U.S. reached out to the CIA for help, they often got no response. NPR also reached out to the CIA and the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to ask about all this. Both agencies declined to comment.
You found that some of these Zero Unit fighters were so frustrated they threatened to harm themselves. What's your sense of how widespread this is?
Yeah, people who've been working with these Afghan soldiers say it's been really widespread. Daoud told me he's scrambled repeatedly to help fellow soldiers who feel hopeless, but he said some didn't make it. And Geeta Bakshi, the former CIA agent, she now leads an aid group for Afghans called FAMIL. She says her organization also started working to prevent suicides as early as 2023.
Individuals from the Zero units unfortunately suffer death by self-harm. We raised this issue to the Biden administration, and again, we saw a direct connection to prolonged immigration delays.
And now, again, Michelle, these Zero Unit fighters and their families are facing new fear and uncertainty. President Trump has suggested many of these Zero Unit fighters may not be allowed to stay in the U.S.
That is NPR's Brian Mann. Brian, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
And let me mention that if you or someone you know is in crisis, call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. That's 988.
Hamas is ready to lay down its weapons for up to 10 years. That's what senior Hamas officials tell NPR as they gear up to negotiate the next stage of the Gaza ceasefire. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
A 20-minute drive away from the skyscrapers of dazzling downtown Doha is the suburb where Hamas's senior leaders are based.
Okay, so this is a beautiful street of
tan buildings, villas, palm trees, decorated walls, and there's a policeman in a car right outside.
Hamas security guards usher us into a parlor room with a Palestinian flag, a Hamas flag, and a photo of the Jerusalem skyline on the wall. We meet senior Hamas negotiator Bassem Naim. He was sitting with Hamas officials in September when Israel tried to kill them.
We were near to end the meeting. At 3:45 p.m., we hear the first missile striking the compound. To be honest, we were not expecting such an attack at that moment.
At that moment, Hamas officials were gathered to review a U.S. ceasefire proposal they had received the day before. He and the other Hamas negotiators survived the airstrikes. The strikes hit an office they had been sitting in just a few minutes before. He says they had moved locations as a security precaution. That failed Israeli strike led to a U.S. success, getting the sides to agree to a ceasefire. Today, Hamas has one more Israeli hostage body to hand over, and then comes the next phase of the ceasefire, with Hamas disarming. Naim says Hamas is willing to negotiate over its weapons.
We are ready to lay down these weapons. I mean not to use it for 5, 7, 10 years, as long as we are not attacked. Because the second question is always, okay, Palestinians have to be disarmed. What about the other side?
Naim says Hamas will not disarm unless there are negotiations toward a Palestinian state. We asked the White House and the Israeli government to respond. Neither commented on the details of Hamas's offer, a disarmament limited in time and the demand for talks toward a Palestinian state. A White House official said Gaza will be fully demilitarized according to President Trump's peace plan, and the U.S. expects Hamas to abide by the deal. An Israeli official says Hamas will have no future under the plan. It will be disarmed and Gaza will be demilitarized. We asked the Hamas officials about their decision to launch the attack which killed around 1,200 people on October 7th, 2 years ago, given the tens of thousands of Palestinians killed in Israel's retaliation. Naim said Hamas should not be held responsible for the devastation of Israel's response.
If you are going to ask me about what happened during these 2 years, this has nothing to do with October 7th, because history didn't start on October 7th. And this has not to do with the response of a state if someone decides to commit a genocide. This is not the mistake or the fault of someone who defended himself.
Israel rejects the charge of genocide in Gaza. We asked if Hamas achieved the goals it laid out in its October 7th attack.
Yes, Hamas has achieved some of the goals of Palestinian people. Before October 7th, the Palestinian question was nearly forgotten.
He said the war brought Palestinians back to the top of the world's agenda and turned public opinion against Israel, even in the U.S. Naim called that a strategic win and irreversible. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Doha, Qatar.
This is NPR News.
Let us head over to the East Shore now, look at traffic in the Hercules area.
Highway 4 eastbound before the 80 interchange, there's a tool block box in the slow lane. In the westbound direction, it's a bit of stop-and-go traffic. Out toward Martinez, Highway 4 between Alhambra and Franklin Canyon, there's some fog and visibility down to as low as 50 feet. And meanwhile, in Pittsburgh, Highway 4 westbound before Bailey Road, an accident there being moved to the center divide. It is slow back to Harbor Street. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Good Wednesday to you. I'm Dave Freeman, 6:43 the time, and that means it's time for a listener perspective. Kristen Nelson shares why it's important for parents to support their children.
A few weeks ago, hundreds of high school students, including my own children, walked out of class to protest gun violence. As a parent and as someone who has spent 2 decades working in school-based mental health and administration, that moment became an unexpected lesson. To be honest, I didn't want my kids to join the walkout. After a recent incident on campus, the chaos surrounding it, and my own parental fears, I questioned whether the walkout could be safe, organized, or effective. I encouraged them to consider alternatives, meet with school leaders in the library, attend a school board meeting, request action through formal channels. Those remain important avenues. But watching our students move as one, peacefully, powerfully, and with purpose, I realized how deeply they felt the urgency. The very youth I have spent my career serving became my teachers once again. Their collective action reminded me of something we, as adults, too often forget. Youth voice is one of our best sources of truth and direction. When they speak in unison, it reflects a reality we haven't been willing or able to confront. Schools are not isolated institutions. They are mirrors. The fear, trauma, and violence in our communities inevitably show up in our classrooms and hallways. Every day, school administrators, teachers, security staff, custodians, and front office workers show up to care for our children, often with limited resources and under extraordinary pressure. Can we improve safety, prevention, and supervision on school campuses? Absolutely, and we should. But we cannot pretend that school staff or even district alone can fix what is fundamentally a community crisis. Where is our collective community response? Where are we showing up? When children take to the streets because adults have failed to protect them, it should shake us awake and then move us to action. Because if young people are the ones stepping forward to protect their future, the very least we can do is show up beside them. With a perspective, I'm Kristen Nelson.
Kristen Nelson is a licensed clinical social worker. Support for Perspectives comes from Leif Cabraser, Hyman & Bernstein, seeking justice for the injured, victims of fraud, whistleblowers, employees, and investors in the Bay Area and nationally for over five decades. Online at lchb.com. On Morning Edition ahead, every December, thousands of runners gather in a small northern Maine town to run a marathon through the frigid woods. The race started as an unlikely way to stoke the town's economy. Also on the way, California stories. Monty Bolaño standing by from San Francisco with the California Report on Wednesday morning here on KQED. Weather report, another day of the same. Lots of dense fog, especially in the inland areas. Look for some sun, a bit of it later today. In the meantime, highs only in the mid-40s to the 60s. Support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to the Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. More at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Every December, thousands of people run a marathon through the woods of northern Maine. They endure freezing temperatures, dress up in costumes, and drink whiskey shooters. It's not just about the race, though. The runners are also there to help one small town rebound from economic devastation. Reporter Grace Benninghoff takes us there.
It's 18 degrees, and Millinocket is filled with people. Runners jog up and down the street to warm up their legs, even as icicles form on their beards and ponytails. They're here to race up a slick logging road and then back through town. The money that thousands of racers bring, whether through registration donations, fundraisers, or the dollars they spend at local businesses, all stays here, in a town that was rocked by the closure of its largest employer, a paper mill, in 2014.
It was devastating. And the town, you know, we've been trying to find business to come in ever since.
That's Trina Vasnes, who worked at the Great Northern Paper Company for 20 years. While the 3,200 runners this year bring hope, they also have a lot to love about the race. Ben Johnson is running dressed as a beekeeper, and his friends came as bees. He's from a town about an hour away.
Cookie Hill is my favorite. The cookie's right at like mile 11 and a half, the top of a hill. Other costumes, there was a flock of deer somewhere. A whole bunch of people in deer onesies. That was a lot of fun.
The temperature inches closer to 20 degrees as the 10 a.m. start time nears.
To your starting position.
A mass of runners line up behind the starting line, between a logging truck and a log loader. Music blares, a gun fires, and they're off. Downtown Millinocket used to be about this busy every weekend. In the mill's heyday, about 7,500 people lived in town. Now, the population is just over 4,000.
You had Muthes, you had Bowling Alley, you had stores where you could buy clothes in, right, instead of the Family Dollar.
The Great Northern Paper Company was one of the largest paper mills in the country, and the town's economy relied on it. Scott Moscone worked at the mill for 27 years.
It was depressing. I mean, everybody's house was up for sales. It was just like the rats leaving the ship. Everybody just bailed out of here, you know.
Gary Allen lives a few hours from Millinocket. After thousands of people lost their jobs, he knew the town needed a spark.
I felt like I would try to do something to help because ultimately they're our neighbors. So I showed up with an idea, a very simple idea, that I and any friends I could attract would run around Millinocket for, you know, 13.1 or 26.2 miles and spend money in town.
And the spark ignited something. That first year, there were 52 runners. The following year, 600 showed up. Now, it's a Boston Marathon qualifying race and thousands participate every year.
Nobody but a crazy person would ever think this would work, that we're going to hold a marathon in frigid northern Maine in December where the temperatures are regularly below zero and that this many people would show up.
Locals are still worried about the fate of Millinocket. And while one weekend may not be enough to transform the economy, it brings something else.
The town's kind of like it used to be with a lot of people in it. Seeing the streets full of people is pretty awesome again. Reminds me of the old days.
Whether runners are qualifying for Boston or walking the race with friends, the event has brought a spark back to Millinocket. Until next December. For NPR News, I'm Grace Benninghoff.
This is NPR News.
Traffic news with Mel ahead of the California Report as we head up to the Napa Valley.
121 westbound in Napa between Highway 29 and Napa Road is stop and go. In Oakville in Napa County, 29 northbound before Gloss Lane, we now have reports that there's a two-vehicle crash we reported earlier, but one of them is blocking a center lane. That's causing traffic to back up in the eastbound direction. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spot Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Marin Country Mart at Larkspur Landing, an authentic 1970s village with more than 40 independent shops, a dozen eateries, and local services such as a toy store, bookstore, and barbershop. MarinCountryMart.com. Support for KQED's card donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Evie Bolaños in San Francisco. California officials are getting ready for a busy week of public meetings on the Tijuana River sewage crisis, a problem communities along the border have been living with for years. The Coastal Commission is meeting this morning in Imperial Beach to take public comment. Tomorrow, state lawmakers will be in La Jolla for a Senate hearing led by Senator Catherine Blakespear and Assemblymember Damon Connolly. And on Friday, Assemblymember David Alvarez is hosting a joint hearing in Chula Vista to talk about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which put $300 million toward treating wastewater in the Tijuana River Valley. All of this comes as roughly 169 billion gallons of polluted water have poured through the valley since 2018. Hundreds of millions of dollars to address homelessness in California is in limbo after the Trump administration reversed course on a major funding program, at least for now. KQED's Aaron Baldessari reports.
For the past two decades, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development has prioritized funding permanent housing. But that changed last month after HUD said it would emphasize encampment sweeps and placing people in temporary housing. Two separate lawsuits from California Attorney General Rob Bonta and Santa Clara and San Francisco counties argued the policy violates federal laws. In response, HUD pulled the new requirements shortly before lawyers were due in court. Ryan Finnegan is a homelessness researcher with UC Berkeley and says the sudden changes are hard on the people who rely on the funding to stay housed.
That combination of not knowing where we're going and it being so sudden, that is giving everybody whiplash.
California has some 96,000 housing units for people who were formerly homeless, of which about a third are funded through this federal program. HUD said it would issue new guidelines in the coming weeks. For the California Report, I'm Aaron Baldessari in San Francisco.
The condominium used to be a relatively affordable home ownership option in California, but it has almost disappeared from our cities. Why? A new generation of housing advocates say California laws have killed the condo, and they want that to change. KCRW contributor Francis Anderton explains.
Michael Anderson was an idealistic young architect developer when he built six condominium townhomes in the late 1990s in the Leimert Park area. He hoped to create an ownership option for black households who are so often left off the real estate ladder. In the weeks leading up to completion and move-in, he checked out the buildings daily.
So as I was maintaining the units, I suddenly got the mailbox full of lawyers soliciting the owners to look at filing legal claims against the developer and the architect.
The mailboxes were stuffed with flyers for condo buyers who weren't even living there yet.
They were basically targeting any defects they could find and said it was sued as a condominium development. Much like injury lawyers today, saying we will get you money for your damaged property. It's like a predator's attack.
Anderson had run headlong into what's known as defect liability. This is a protection for condominium owners in California, giving them 10 years in which they can sue their architect or builder over defects or shoddy construction. But housing advocates argue that plaintiff attorneys have been so eager to sue, and builders and designers have to pay such high insurance to protect themselves, it's created a major roadblock to the production of condos.
They wanted to protect buyers from unscrupulous developers.
Michael Lane is a state policy director at SPUR, which is a Bay Area planning and urban research nonprofit.
But as all things happen, and typically in California, we overcorrect. And so we put laws in place that now not only protect the consumer, but make it impossible to them to even have access to the product.
Condos are an entry-level home ownership option in much of North America, not in the Golden State. One research group found that in the 2010s, condos made up almost 40% of new multifamily housing in Canada, whereas in California during the same period,
only 3% of multifamily homes are built for sale.
Mohammed Alameldin is senior policy advisor at California YIMBY, or Yes in My Backyard.
So we're kind of creating this dichotomy within California where if you cannot afford a single family home, you are going to be stuck as a renter, right? We've legalized luxury SUVs and we've outlawed Toyotas.
As for Leimert Park developer Michael Anderson, his condos were a success for his first-time buyers. But he never built another condo development.
You're still scared during the period, right? Because you could be called into a court in legal situations, which would wipe out the profit of doing the project anyway. It discourages you from building, actually. And you see, that's why developers really look at it like, do I want to take this risk?
Michael Lane from SPUR says the laws need updating.
And so we really think it's time for California to get on task here and to actually revise these laws and still protecting the consumer and the home buyer.
A reform bill last year never got a hearing in Sacramento. It was opposed by consumer attorneys. Lane says another way to address defect liability could be a warranty program, requiring the builder to guarantee their work. He also wants a deposit system for buyers to provide less costly financing for developers. So he's working with a state legislator on a multi-pronged effort to ease the path for condos. Mohammed Alameldin with California YIMBY supports the effort.
We have to solve the condo problem. Like, if we want teachers, nurses, young families to ever buy a home here, we need to create a financial model that supports building the types of units that people could buy. And condos are the global starter home.
2025 has been a big year for housing proponents, with SB 79, a new requirement to allow denser building in California's cities, and an overhaul of CEQA, the state's Environmental Act. Expect 2026 to be a year in which affordable home ownership gets more attention. For the California Report, I'm Frances Anderton in Los Angeles.
Support for the California Report comes from Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and adult and children's health systems working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. Block Construction, building communities where Californians live, learn, and connect. Block Construction, helping build futures since 1970. More info at block.com, BLACH.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
And that is the California Report for Wednesday, December 10th. We're a production of KQED News. I'm Evie Bolaños. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Morning edition, KQED News, all ahead in a minute. At 6:59, we'll check in with Mel and find out about traffic conditions in Fremont.
680 northbound before the Auto Mall Parkway. Debris is in the left lane in San Lorenzo. I-238 is slow, is the area you'll start to see slow traffic on southbound 880. It'll continue down to Alvarado Boulevard. The backup on the San Mateo Bridge is now from the Interpretive Center to the Toll Plaza. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support on Wednesday comes from Murphy Mechanic Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. Good morning. I'm Dave Freeman. Thanks for listening.